Hello, welcome to the Law Report. I'm Damien Carrick. Today, capital punishment.
We must continue arguing strongly that the death penalty is unjust and incompatible with the fundamental human rights. I urge leaders where the death penalty still is used to legally commute or pardon death sentences and to impose moratoriums on executions. The death penalty has no place in the 21st century.
That's UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon speaking on Friday in his address for World Day Against the Death Penalty. When you think about capital punishment, you probably think about the large numbers executed in countries like China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, North Korea, and the USA. Closer to home in Southeast Asia, the number of executions is much lower. And I think it's fair to say that we only pay close attention to death sentences in our region when Australians are involved. On World Day Against the Death Penalty, I hosted an event organised by Reprieve Australia. It's a group that wants us to engage with our neighbours, to work with Southeast Asians who are currently seeking to end capital punishment. The conversation included some legal heavy hitters. Mulya Lubis, one of Indonesia's most prominent lawyers. He is in fact the legal advocate for incoming President Joko Widodo in a challenge to the recent election results. He's also the country's leading anti-death penalty advocate. Justice Lex Lasry of the Supreme Court of Victoria. Before becoming a judge, he acted for Melbourne man Van Thuong Nguyen, a convicted drug trafficker who was executed in Singapore in December 2005. Professor Pip Nicholson, Director of the Asian Law Centre at the University of Melbourne. She's provided pro bono advice to the families of a number of Australians on death row in Vietnam. Journalist Hamish McDonald, who's lived and worked in many Asian cities. And also criminal defence barrister Matthew Goldberg, the current president of Reprieve Australia. Matthew keeps an eye on the number of death penalty sentences and actual executions.
In the Southeast Asian region, Indonesia, Thailand, Singapore, Vietnam and Malaysia all have the death penalty. We're working with local organisations in each of those countries.
How many people are on death row and how common are executions in these places?
In Indonesia, there were 5 executions last year. That came following 5 years without any executions, and there'd been a suggestion at that time of a moratorium. In Singapore, there haven't been any executions last year or the year before, and one in the year before that. In Vietnam, last year there were said to be only 9 executions and 19 before then. But they all come with an asterisk, subject to transparency and release of the figures. As we understand it, Vietnam's the most prolific of executions in the region. So in Vietnam, there are said to be about 50 sentences of death, about 150 sentences of death the year before then. And in Malaysia, not quite the comparable figures, but certainly dozens of people sentenced to death on an annual basis.
And how many people are executed in Malaysia?
Last year, the figures illustrate only 2 executions, but we suspect that there were more, and limited numbers of executions published in the years before them, but also we suspect more. In Thailand, there haven't been, well, there have all but been no executions of many years, but the number of sentences of death exceeds those in Malaysia.
What's the profile of those people who are sentenced to death and those people who are executed?
Well, certainly varies, but in relation to drug offences, ordinarily is a person poor, engaged in the practice of drug trafficking out of desperation, likely to earn only a small fee as a consequence of their involvement, without support by family or society, either within the country or often foreign citizens travelling for that purpose alone.
So these aren't the kingpins at the top of the drug cartels?
Extraordinarily unlikely to be, no.
Hamish McDonald, you're somebody who's lived in a number of different Asian countries. Acknowledging the enormous diversity of the region, what's the attitude of most people in Southeast Asia to capital punishment?
Well, I think it varies a lot, actually. Some countries have taken a stand against it. Timor-Leste ruled out capital punishment when it became independent. The Philippines abolished the death penalty in 2006. And commuted the sentences of 1,200 or so people who are on death row, the biggest commutation in history anywhere. Some of the other countries have not applied the death penalty, even though they have it on the books. And there doesn't seem to be much correlation between the kind of level of violence in the society and the nation and the use of the death penalty. And if you cast the net wider, you look at, say, Singapore and Japan, two of the safest countries in Asia, the two that are perhaps most wedded to the death penalty.
What's your sense of the philosophy or the thinking behind the death penalty in Asia? Again, acknowledging the extraordinary diversity, do you see any commonalities in the approach?
If you could really generalise, you could say that there is a great deal of leniency towards criminals early in their career. Sentences are quite light for quite serious offences, but when you get up to serial killings, mass murder, repeat offences, then people have thought to have sort of gone beyond redemption, and it's seen as something that is entirely just and, you know, the appropriate thing under heaven for them to disappear from society.
Mulya Lubis, in Indonesia, do the majority support the death penalty?
Well, most of them support death penalty. I don't know how many percentage of them, but most of them, yes.
In Western countries, we tend to think of violent crime as the most serious offending. But is that the same in Indonesia? Is there that kind of clear hierarchy of offences and accompanying punishments?
Public opinion considered drug trafficking as the most serious crime, yeah?
The most serious crime.
That's my reading, yeah? Because it is also stipulated in the law.
There have been, I think, we were hearing about three or four executed recently. Who have they been? Have they been Indonesians or have they been foreigners or a mix of both?
Well, most of them are foreigners, but there are, of course, a lot of Indonesians waiting to be executed, yeah? But last year, among the five executed, I don't think there is any Indonesian, yeah? Quite a lot from Africa, yeah?
I understand that there are a number of Africans on death row. They're more than you might expect, but they don't actually control the drug trade in Indonesia, do they? Are they just the low-level couriers?
Well, I think this is stereotyping, you know, that's being, you know, applied to the Africans, yeah? I do have one client from Nigeria waiting for executions. I don't think there is enough evidence, though, to support the death penalty, you know, for them. So I think the dangers of stereotypings in Indonesia is very, very dangerous.
Justice Lathry, you acted for Melbourne man Van Nguyen. He was convicted of drug trafficking in Singapore and executed in 2005. Hamish and Mulya are describing a kind of a deep-seated and widely held idea that this is the way it is. Judicial executions are okay. Was that your experience in Singapore? When you were there, was there a debate about this issue?
No, I don't think there was much debate going on in Singapore itself. There were what I recall as being a fairly small group of people who were subject to some professional differences supported us. But by and large, the attitude in Singapore in 2005, so 9 years ago, was that foreigners who were involved in drug trafficking basically deserved what they got. I don't think there was an appetite then for any discussion about abolition, though the issue was on the radar at the time.
Pip Nicholson, what about Vietnam? How prevalent is capital punishment and how is it viewed? I mean, from the numbers that we were hearing before, it seems that it's just part of the course.
We've all struggled to get good data out of Vietnam. One of the sets of figures I've seen says about 100 a year.
Sentences.
Sentenced. And there was a hiatus in Vietnam when there were no executions between 2011, when the party state determined to cease execution by firing squad and introduce lethal injection. And then executions were resumed in August 2013.
I read in January there was a mass trial where 30 people were sentenced to death in the one trial for trafficking something like 12 tonnes of heroin.
Yep.
How good are these trials?
They're entirely different trials from anything we would experience here.
Or hope for. Let's talk about Australians. Matthew Goldberg, how many Australians are on death row in Asia at the moment?
On death row, so sentenced to death, only two that we can speak to formally, Andrew Chan and Maran Sukumaran in Indonesia.
Two of the Bali Nine.
Yeah. There are other Australians who are in some way subject to the penalty of death in Asia. So they might have proceedings that are on foot or proceedings that are anticipated. But as we understand it, there aren't otherwise Australians at that final stage, but for Andrew and Myron.
Pip Nicholson. Is that your view? What do we know about Australians on death row in Vietnam? Are there any?
Yes, there are.
How many?
My data, which, as you know, Damien, was sourced from the media, says that since 2001 there's been between 34 and 35 Australian citizens prosecuted for drug offences. So technically many of them faced the possibility of the death penalty as a result of the very, well, relatively low amount of heroin resulting in a death penalty conviction. But of that group, six were sentenced to death.
Six sentenced to death. Why don't we know their names?
Well, six sentenced to death, all of whom were ultimately granted clemency by the president. Subsequent to the appeals processes in Vietnam, an individual can seek clemency. And in all six cases, and indeed in all cases involving Westerners since 1975, only one has ever been executed in Vietnam.
Okay, Chappelle Corby, Van Nguyen, Andrew Chan, Myuran Sukumaran, these people are household names. They're splashed across the media. We don't know the names of any of these Australians you've just been talking about. 33 who've been prosecuted, the six who have been on death row, sitting in Vietnamese jails. Why don't we know their stories?
Look, I've looked at that question and I think there's a couple of responses. A lot of Australian media does not have a correspondent based in Vietnam. Many trials are held without the presence of any media. There is a substantial language component. All trials and all Vietnamese media is in Vietnamese. And while a lot of Australian journalists speak Chinese and Indonesian, speaking Vietnamese is less common. But I think there is another reason. And I think those who have been involved in assisting with the defence or working with local lawyers in Vietnam on these cases are anxious to let the clemency process run its course without necessarily seeing that upset by the intrusion of a counter-narrative from a Western media source about the inappropriateness of the death penalty.
Are you telling me that lawyers and families don't want a media circus because that might push the Vietnamese government into a corner?
My research suggests that it is profoundly unwise to run a media circus for anyone facing a death penalty case in Vietnam. Let me just clarify, Damien, there are two types of media. It is very helpful to run a moral narrative about a defendant facing serious charges in the local press. So, for example, if your defendant has been coerced or manipulated into offending, it is good to get that story out there in the Vietnamese press, but it is unhelpful to have Western media or foreign media sandwiching, is how I would call it, sandwiching the leadership, which is minded to consider seriously clemency applications from a range of governments.
Vietnam's a poor country. It gets a lot of aid from Australia. Perhaps that's a consideration that it wouldn't be in say, a middle-income country. They don't want to be painted into a corner any more than we want our citizens executed. Is that fair to say?
I think there's a range of political sensitivities in these cases, Damien. I think the party state wants to maintain a range of very constructive relationships with a range of governments. I think that's true. But I think the relationship involves aid, trade and investment, reform narratives, constructive debate around different ways of doing things. So I think there's a range of factors at play.
So there's almost a nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
I certainly wouldn't be saying it was a nudge-nudge, wink-wink. I would say it's a carefully calibrated political discussion between two governments.
And an effective one, because nobody has been executed.
And I'm not here to upset that relationship, Damien.
Justice Lasry, one person's story we know a great deal about is Van Nguyen. You acted for him in the legal case, but there was also a media campaign, an attempt to sway Singaporeans and the Singaporean government, and maybe to sway the Australian government and Australian public opinion. Looking back to Van Nguyen's case, what did you learn about getting your message across to the Singaporean audience?
Well, our media during that case probably was primarily aimed at the Australian community. Early on in that case, I was in the office of Alexander Downer, who assured me that nobody in Australia would be the slightest bit interested in Ban Nguyen's fate. He did not think, that was his then opinion, that the Australian community had any appetite for this boy was in Singapore. He took the chance. Basically, he deserved what he got. My concern, at least at that stage, was that we didn't want the Australian government to be simply rolling its arm over. We needed to have some public knowledge about this case to ensure that the government stepped up to the mark and applied some level of pressure, diplomatically, privately, politically, with the Singapore government. Now, the reality is, looking back at it, I think Van Nguyen was dead from the time he was arrested. I think the Singapore government was never going to offer him clemency. But along the way, at least in my mind, there was the next case to be thought about. There were lessons to be learned from the way that case was conducted, which I think have had some effect.
What lessons have been learned?
I learned fairly early on that about the most counterproductive thing you can do is be insulting. And it really ill behoves Australians to be too insulting about countries that have the death penalty, because after all, until the 1970s, we had a mandatory death penalty too. But I came to the conclusion that there was a debate, which was probably a long-term debate, in which Australia could participate to persuade Asian countries with the death penalty to reconsider their position.
So there's a real danger in finger-wagging to intelligent people who've made thought-through decisions about
Absolutely.
How they want to conduct their criminal yeah. justice.
And particularly in Southeast Asia, they do not appreciate being lectured to by us. And I understand that, and quite rightly.
In recent years, there has been some softening in Singapore. It's now possible to commute a death penalty if a convicted drug trafficker can show they only transported drugs and if they also provide assistance or evidence to disrupt or investigate drug trafficking. In 2012, Yong Vui Kong, a Malaysian national, was the first on death row in Singapore to have his sentence reduced to life. I'm Damien Carrick. This is The Law Report. You're listening to a special forum for World Day Against the Death Penalty. My guests are Mulya Lubis, Justice Lex Lasry, Professor Pip Nicholson, Hamish McDonald and Matthew Goldberg.
Now, we've been speaking about Singapore and before that Vietnam. Of course, every country is very different. Indonesia is a very open place, a very rambunctious place. Chappelle Corby, the Bali Nine, is there a danger that sometimes death row cases or drug trafficking prosecutions can become a bit of a media circus? And how does that impact on the whole kind of process and maybe what goes on behind the scenes and the decisions about politicians to commute or not to commute a death sentence? Mulya Lubis.
Well, we are lucky to have a free press in Indonesia. Nothing is confidential. But at the same time, of course, you know, there is a risk to have over-publications. And we, being lawyers, in many occasions have to restrain ourselves because we don't want to corner the authorities, the judges, and at the same time, we don't want to have our client receive retaliations. This is the art of using media, and it depends on a case-by-case basis.
There's certainly an evolution of attitudes and policies in a number of countries, including Indonesia and Singapore. Mulya Lubis, in 2007, you actually argued a case before Indonesia's Constitutional Court on behalf of some of the Bali Nine and a number of Indonesians also on death row. You argued that a constitutional right to life be applied to capital punishment. I think you lost 3-6, I think, in yes. the Constitutional Court. So there's debate obviously taking place at the highest levels of judicial circles, judges, and also maybe sometimes politicians. But I understand that there's another dynamic operating in Indonesia. Millions of Indonesians work abroad, especially in Saudi Arabia and Malaysia, and some of them have been sentenced to death. And these cases have really galvanised a debate in Indonesia. I'd like to hear from both Mulya and Hamish on this.
Well, we put forward that argument before the court at the time because Indonesian government spent a lot of money defending Indonesian migrant workers facing death penalty in Saudi Arabia, in Malaysia, and in other parts of the countries. I think Indonesia has very valid points in defending those Indonesian migrant workers. The double standard is they defend Indonesian citizens against death penalty overseas, but at the same time in Indonesia, they apply death penalty. And there's no ground for Indonesia to enforce death penalty in Indonesia while at the same time defending Indonesian migrant workers from facing death penalty overseas.
There are about nearly 200 Indonesians on death row in Saudi Arabia, some other Gulf states, and Malaysia. And many of these cases produce the same kind of media circus in Indonesia that we see with Australians. Quite often the cases involve young women working as housemaids who've been raped by the male employer or relentlessly bullied by the female housewife, and they've struck out, and a case that might have been a manslaughter somewhere else is a murder and drawn the death penalty. So you've got these harrowing cases of people in Saudi Arabia's case, very remote systems, and in Malaysia, one where there are automatic death penalties. So you've had the kind of press uproar, and in fact, during the recent presidential election, one of the candidates, Prabowo Subianto, actually went up to Malaysia to try to lobby for one rather famous Indonesian young woman who was in a murder trial. And I think the result was that there was not a death sentence in that case. As Dr. Lubis said, it's sort of thrown it back on the Indonesian government that, you know, unless we're a bit lenient and understanding and so on, we can't expect to ask the same of other countries.
There is, of course, a change of presidency taking place in Indonesia. That transition, does that offer any hope for people who are currently on death row, especially, well, I ask in relation to the Australians, but also more generally? Mulnya?
Well, President-elect Jokowi is committed to uphold human rights. He hasn't spoken yet about death penalty, but I do believe he himself believes in the right to life. But the group which opposes President Jokowi in Parliament outnumbers Jokowi's supporters. So it's not going to be easy, but I would like to keep the hope alive, to remain optimistic on this.
Well, what should Australia's role be in campaigning against the death penalty? We have lawyers like Lex Lasry and Matthew Goldberg acting for individual Australians on death row, but is there scope for another kind of engagement? Matthew, in recent years, Reprieve Australia has shifted its focus towards Southeast Asia. So you're placing lawyers and law students in like-minded organisations in various parts of Southeast Asia.
Yeah, that's right.
Traditionally, you used to send many people to Louisiana and other states in the Deep South, but now you're reorienting your focus and your resources?
That's right, it's a pivot.
Pivot, yeah.
We're maintaining the work that we do in the US, and that's significant, I think, and relevant to Southeast Asia. If there's change within the US system, then there might be change elsewhere, and it's also important to protect people who are subject to death in whatever jurisdiction that happens to be. We're only operating within those countries in Southeast Asia because we've been invited to, and we're there to simply support and provide resources to the lawyers who we know already share the same opinion that we have, that they're opposed to the death penalty.
And Mulya Lubis, what's your view of this kind of engagement?
Well, it has always been useful, but of course, you know, we have to be very careful because sometimes under certain conditions, we should not go too far.
What do you mean?
Well, the authority is very sensitive, and this kind of engagement, if it is blown up, that would be embarrassing, you know, for the authority. So I think I welcome the engagement. I think we have to do that because we need all the resources from other countries. Yeah, but we really have to be careful, you know, in some instances.
And how would you want Australians to be careful in the way they contribute to these debates or to this work?
Well, in some cases, perhaps it is important to bring the local, the Indonesians, on board more and more. Although we have been having a very constructive relationship, you know, between our countries, things are not going that well sometimes. So the sensitivity of the relationship between Indonesia and Australia has to be taken into consideration.
Lex Lasry and Pip Nicholson, do you welcome this involvement? I would imagine that in some ways it's really good to have people who are there contributing while there are no high-profile cases involving Australians. That way we separate the commitment away from issues that can be perceived as self-interest. Do you have a view, both of you?
I'm not sure this is quite an answer to the question, but if I might say, Damien, Matthew referred to reprieve and efforts going on in Louisiana, and of course reprieve in Australia is the product of the efforts of people like Richard Burke and others.
He's an Australian lawyer based in Louisiana who's done extraordinary stuff.
Doing death penalty cases in America every day of his life. And it rather underlines the difference, because in the Nguyen case, I tried twice to be admitted in Singapore so that I could argue the case myself, and was twice refused. So the role is different. The role for lawyers and people who are trying to assist has to be at a distance and in cooperation with local lawyers, because the prospects of an Australian lawyer, for example, ever being allowed to argue a case in a Southeast Asian court is just about non-existent. So obviously the orientation of people who are trying to help has to be quite different from the way it's conducted in the United States. Observing the caution that Mollier refers to, and the sort of caution that I learned and we all learned as we travelled through that particular case.
I think that's entirely right, and I've certainly really enjoyed watching Reprieve's approach in Southeast Asia. I see it as sensitive, I see it as nuanced, trying to work with and foster the skills and the resources that might assist in high-profile death penalty cases. And I think there is a lot that Australian lawyers, or indeed lawyers from anywhere around the world, can do to assist their colleagues in Southeast Asia.
Finally, Matthew Goldberg, I understand you're involved in the cases of Andrew Chan and Mayuran Sukumaran, two Australians on death row in Bali. You visited them last month. How are they doing?
Both Andrew and Myron continue to exhibit just really remarkable strides of rehabilitation. Myron paints, maintains an art class for other prisoners, and Andrew too has been studying and is pursuing other culinary training courses for the inmates. So there's a whole raft of things that they're doing that you wouldn't imagine would be possible in that environment and potentially subject to that penalty.
Perhaps redemption or a meaningful life is possible.
Yeah, that's right, that not all is lost and that there's scope to change, even if it wasn't immediately evident at the time of arrest, of trial, of sentence. Certainly they'll persist as they have done, and their application for clemency remains before the president.
It might be a good place to leave our discussion. Would you please help me thank our guests, Jakarta lawyer Mulya Lubis, Justice Lex Lasry of the Victorian Supreme Court, Professor Pip Nicholson, journalist and author Hamish McDonald, and barrister Matthew Goldberg, President of Reprieve Australia.
That's the Law Report for this week. A big thank you to producer Anita Barrow and also to audio producer Brendan O'Neill. Do visit our website at abc.net.au/rn. There you can find audio on demand, transcripts, and also, of course, podcasts. And podcasts are also available at iTunes. Talk to you next week with more Law.